Utopia. So this is where the Nazis were welcomed after they tried to liquidate the Jews. I heard they were set up in some part of Argentina like it was their second kingdom of Bavaria. Also heard that when a Nazi died, they gave him the full Nazi send-off, in uniforms and all. Ibo said. Nazis were Christians, and it's still the religion of white supremacy. They have used Christianity to control the black man by giving him a lie to cling on to as hope. Don't start, Ibo. Don't start. You and Savage and your black conversations are trying. I like Kiana Savage because she keeps it real. We know the truth. The black man has been manipulated by the offspring of the evil bastards who kidnapped and enslaved his forefathers. A black man using the white man's Bible is the best example of Stockholm Syndrome to date. If blacks are in a white man's heaven, they are janitors and maids. You're not fun to be around when you're not drunk. When you're sober, you're depressing. You're fun drunk. You dance, you sing, you tell jokes. Sober, you're a bitch. I guess no one wants to talk about how Hitler didn't die in Germany, didn't commit suicide, but fled here in a submarine and lived out the rest of his days. The FBI knew he was chilling at the Eden Hotel. Argentina and Nazi Germany were kissing cousins who wanted to finger-fuck the rest of the world. Argentina was storing uranium for the Nazis and was trying to help them build a nuclear bomb. Bet you didn't know all of that, did you, Butcherman? Who gives a fuck? Somebody get the delusional African drunk. I like him drunk.
Laughter spread around the room. Ibo stretched, yawned, went to check out the view, see what the butcher could see. Medianoche picked up a remote, put the skirmish on mute, then turned on music, let Frank Sinatra sing The September of My Years, allowed that song to score the battle. Medianoche's cellular rang. It was Caprico Ortiz. He was to meet the Porteña at the regular hotel for 2 hours. It was his downtime, personal time to get away and relieve stress. Señorita Raven adjusted her tie and asked, "Was that Assad with our new shipment?"
"Not Assad. Has to do with the other contracts, the Nunca Mas contract."
"Caprica Ortiz?"
"Yes, Caprica Ortiz."
"Another meeting?"
"Yes, another meeting."
There was a tap at the door. Kiana Savage entered, hurried, greeted her superiors. She said, "Some fucktard is trying to hack into our systems again. Looks like it's out of Russia, but I think the signal's being bounced around the globe. The system is secure now." Señorita Raven cursed. "Did they get anything? What's the damage?" "Dr. Spots shut it down immediately, but he wants your eyes on the issue." Medianoche looked to Señorita Raven. She said, "I'm on it. Give me 2 minutes." His cellular rang again. It was Preacher. Medianoche took a beat before he said,
"We thought you had gone Elvis."
"I found her, sir. I found Thelma. She uses the name Catherine Rousseau Gautier." He stood up.
"It's confirmed that it is her? I don't want it to be anyone else but her."
"It's confirmed. I used her home address to find her cellular provider, and then I accessed her cellular records. She only called a few people, and one was in the area. Recently, she called the number several times a day. I reverse-engineered the number and retrieved the home address, then came to the area and parked. The garage door went up, and one of the cars inside is registered in her name. Sir, there is no doubt in my mind."
"Where is Thelma hiding?"
"In Smyrna, hiding in a townhome rented by Jeremy Bentham. She's outside Atlanta in the burbs. Pardon the noise. A train is going by. Railroad runs through this area."
"Gideon is there?"
"He could be hiding inside."
"You're on surveillance?"
"I've been sitting here."
"We already lost 3 down there. I want to send someone up to take charge, but that could cost precious time. Can you handle this assignment? Don't bullshit me, soldier."
"I have the layout of the townhome. Pulled it up online from when it was listed as a rental. The management company never took the ad down. I have all the info I need."
"Good. Drive on. Do nothing before old dark's stupid. Don't make a move in daylight and fuck it up like you did with the landscaper. Do you understand? Can you handle this by—"
At that moment, the butcher reached to open the patio door so he could step outside into the cold, maybe to check out the view toward Rio de la Plata. The glass door shattered. Something whizzed by Senorita Raven and destroyed the lower part of the wall. Ebo and the butcher were one behind the other, almost in ranger file. That was how they fell. A hole was in the butcher's neck, had destroyed most of his neck, and that same bullet had continued, destroyed the Nigerian's heart. It had barely missed Kiana Savage's left knee. She felt its energy. She screamed, then realized they were under attack. Medianoche hit the floor as he pulled out his sidearm. Get down! Another projectile destroyed the patio door. A round blew a hole in the wall. Two more rounds destroyed furniture. Kiana Savage tried to pull the fallen horseman out of the line of fire. Senorita Raven shouted, We're getting hit with 50 caliber rounds! They were attacked like they were Black Panthers being raided by Hoover's FBI. The gunfire paused. Medianoche commanded, Savage, get a fix from another room and be fucking careful! Kiana Savage had frozen, had lost her training, was in a knot. Many well-trained soldiers did that in combat when death was so close. Medianoche barked, Savage, get off your black ass and get a fix on the enemy! Kiana Savage took three deep breaths, and she complied. Weapon in hand, she stayed low, scurried, backed out of the apartment. Medianoche and Senorita Raven moved to opposite sides, came together at the shattered window, weapons in hand, searching for a target, and tried to get a fix on the sniper. They didn't know if it was the Russians, the French, or the men from Uruguay. They saw their enemy. Their antagonist was in the building across the street. The renegade, with the death wish, stood next to a sniper's rifle. He wasn't hiding. He wore all black. He pulled the black hoodie back from his head. It was a side zip-up, long sleeve. He wore a mask. Then he pulled away his balaclava. It was Thelma's bastard son. Gideon had returned. The fucking gaucho was back. And he had become a beast. The gaucho began shooting again. Chapter 22. Some deserve to die. 20 floors above the ground, charges blew the hinges off the door. Horsemen threw flash and bang into the apartment where the gaucho Gideon had been holed up. Horsemen entered, locked and loaded, weapons high, mentally back in the Middle East, in Iraq, in Fallujah. Carrying a ballistic shield, Medianoche moved in first. He wanted this kill to belong to him. Senorita Raven was right on his heels. Medianoche could tell his XO was anxious to empty her clip in the bastard she was convinced was his son. Tiburon, Dr. Spots, and Black Mamba came in behind their XO. They were geared up, nervous, angry, hyped, and dying for revenge. The windows had been left open. Boot prints were on the floor where he had moved around. The room was freezing. Nothing was in the small apartment except scattered shells below the window. A prepaid cell phone was on the counter in the kitchen. Next to the prepaid phone was a package of BC powder. Both sat on top of an unsigned Father's Day card. A worn paperback was on the floor by the window. 10 Little Indians by Agatha Christie. Senorita Raven said, He's on the run. The bastard who had left Medianoche dead on the floor of a whorehouse in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, had snuck back into Buenos Aires and was hunting the hunters. Senorita Raven picked up the cellular their prey had left behind. She said, It hasn't been used. There's one number programmed in memory. Medianoche took the phone from her. He shoved it in his pocket. Black Mamba asked, What does the book mean? Dr. Spots said, 10 Little Indians. Black Mamba said,
So he set up shop here and was reading a mystery novel, waiting for the right moment.
Medianoche told his men, Sweep the floor. Someone go downstairs. Be with Cobra, Clutterbuck, and Savage. And be careful. Keep away from the windows. He has a 50 cal. Senorita Raven pointed at two horsemen. Black Mamba, Dr. Spots, go downstairs and work your way up floor by floor. We will work our way down and meet in the middle. Black Mamba and Dr. Spots hurried out and boarded the elevator. The elevator had opened as soon as they pushed the button. It didn't have to come up from Piso Cero. Medianoche paused when he saw that. The elevator had been here, waiting for them. As soon as the elevator door opened, his men rushed on. Medianoche remembered something. The novel. His mother had read that novel when it was called Ten Little Niggers. The title of the Agatha Christie novel had changed over the years. Ten Little Niggers became Ten Little Indians. Years later, when political correctness had taken root, it was called And Then There Were None. But it had also been called Ten Little Soldiers. No matter the name, it was the same story. Someone had been offended, and one by one, everyone in the tale died. He had remembered all of that in the blink of an eye, and his panic set in. Medianoche screamed and ran toward the lift. Get off the lift! Don't take the fucking elevator! The elevator door closed hard and fast. Unusually hard. Unusually fast. There was an explosion. All the horsemen fell into defensive positions. Dr. Spots screamed loud enough to be heard through the doors.
Fuck was that?
Then a second explosion came from above them, in the shaft. Medianoche heard his men in the elevator. They were alive. They were shook up, but uninjured. Medianoche and his team struggled to pull the elevator doors open, tugged until he could see a sliver of the inside. He saw his men inside doing the same, fighting to open the doors. But it was like a steel trap. They would need the jaws of life to open it fully. Black Mamba was sweating, shaken, but composed under fire. He assessed the situation. His temperament remained stolid, phlegmatic, as he fought with Dr. Spots to open the jammed doors. Black Mamba said,
We're okay. We just got rocked a bit. The explosion was above us.
Teeth gritted, still tugging. Medianoche said,
These doors have been tampered with.
Senorita Raven yelled,
We'll get you out. We got your six. Trust me, we got you.
They heard something break in the chute above them. Some debris fell on the roof. Dr. Spots panicked.
The wiring snapped! I heard the fucking wiring!
The elevator slipped 2 feet. They fought to open the door. It skated downward again. They dropped weapons and used all of their muscle. As a group, they had it opened only 8 inches. Black Mamba tried to force open the car top escape hatch, but it wasn't like in the movies. It had to be opened with a fireman's key or from the other side. Black Mamba trained his gun on the hatch and fired off a few rounds. That solved the problem. When he opened the hatch, gunfire erupted from above. 6 fast shots. He had been hit in the clavicle. He dropped and screamed like they had never heard a man scream before. He screamed like he had been shot 9 times. Dr. Spots returned fire, sent bullets up into the darkness, heard his shots ping, ricochet.
Get me the fuck out of this elevator! Get me out! Get me the fuck!
The lift slipped again. Dr. Spots looked at Medianoche, pleading to be rescued. The lift slipped another 9 inches, then fell another foot. Dr. Spots looked at the other horseman, his plea the same. The elevator had slid down, now was between floors. They saw Dr. Spots sweating hard, panting. Then the lift dropped another foot and forced them to lose their grip. Dr. Spots banged on the walls with his sidearm and screamed, Do something! The lift dropped another foot. There was a sound from above, a whining, a harsh wail as debris fell, the din of metal fighting metal, then separating from metal when cables snapped. The hydraulic elevator, which lifted and lowered elevator cars using a piston jack, failed. The safeties that kept the lift from dropping no longer worked. As if he knew what was next, Dr. Spots lowered his gun and whispered,
Fuck.
Then the lift plummeted, became a victim of gravity and height. They were 20 floors up, 21 when the lobby was included. Force would equal mass times acceleration. The car was falling so fast, the men were now on its ceiling. On impact, the car would stop, and they would keep going, slamming into the floor. Air from the falling lift pushed back up into their faces. Senorita Raven gritted her teeth and prayed, It'll stop, it'll stop, it'll stop. The elevator was overspeeding. Metal shrieked. A safety device was supposed to grip the rails and bring the car to a safe stop. It should have happened within seconds, but the car stayed in free fall. Medianoche cursed aloud, sensed that all mechanisms that prevented the lift from staying in free fall had been tampered with, were completely disabled. That was virtually impossible to do, would take a genius and an act of God, but it had been done. Medianoche heard it falling. He looked up at the digital numbers. They had become a countdown to death. The horsemen froze, hearts beating rapidly, praying to their gods for this to work out in their favor, because they were the goddamn righteous ones. The speed was too great. If it stopped suddenly, that would cause at minimum a fatal head injury. They yelled when they heard the heartbreaking crash, the explosion when it landed in the lobby. They yelled. like they had been in that box with Dr. Spots and Black Mamba. Then the multi-ton elevator cable in assembly dropped for 20-plus floors, pulled by gravity, and crashed down onto the elevator. It crushed the carriage and the men inside. Vibrations rose, juddered the edifice. It shook dangerous men and women who were already shaken. The Gaucho had outsmarted a braking system that hadn't failed for 150 years, turned the elevator into a weapon. Dust rose from down below. The horsemen sent curses, fired upward into the hollow of the elevator shaft, did their best to make a body drop. Medianoche wanted Gideon to have the same fall. He wanted to see him dropped. Then he would shoot him until he hit bottom. Medianoche shouted,
"Get to the roof! He's not in the shaft! He's on the roof!"
Tiburon, the soldier with six fingers and six toes, stopped and shook his head. He was in the hallway and yelled,
"Commander, something dropped from the roof!"
It was quick, but felt like it was in slow motion. Tiburon pointed out the window in the apartment they had ransacked. Medianoche and Senorita Raven turned just in time to see a body fall from above. It dropped fast, like a trapped man had jumped to commit suicide in order to face his fate, in order to prevent having what happened to Scams happen to him. They ran to the window. They saw Gideon. Like the elevator had been, he was in free fall, dropping like a rock. Only this was different. A red and black parachute popped open, and the winter winds carried him away toward the mostly middle-class area called Almagro, in the direction of Avenida Rivadavia and Avenida Irigoyen. While they were distracted, the son of a whore had gone to the roof and base-jumped from the 25th floor. He floated through dreary skies, rain, and snow, maneuvered around concrete edifices that made Buenos Aires seem like the New York of South America. Senorita Raven shouted, "He's bugging out!" The target was too far away to get a good shot. But Medianoche tried. Senorita Raven tried. And his six-fingered soldier, Tiburon, tried. Gideon landed in traffic, bending legs and rolling after the impact, like a professional. He missed being run over by a truck, then his parachute was abandoned in the streets, and he was gone. Took off moving in the direction of the intersection of Estado de Israel and Estado de Palestina. It had been 15 seconds from the roof to the streets, and like in New York, now he had a million places to chill out and plan his escape, or his next move. In 10 minutes, he could go anywhere. In 20, he could be on a boat crossing the river again. In an hour, he could be on a plane flying to parts unknown. Senorita Raven shouted into her headpiece, told the other horsemen the location.
"Get there fast! Get moving! Cobra, your team leader! Break that bastard to back if you have to!"
Tiburon said, "Only a madman would do a base jump from this height, in this weather. Only an insane person would attack us. But Juan did. He just called us out. Who the hell is he?" Medianoche commanded,
"Check the roof! See who is on his team! Shoot to kill!"
They checked from pole to pole, found no one. There were boot prints from one man. This time, there was no Russian, no one to replace the landscaper. Looked like he was on his own. Medianoche felt like the beast was attacking him from his grave, Gideon, his proxy. When they hurried 20 floors down to the ground floor, freezing air, cold rain, and hints of snow blew in on the disaster. They stood, sweating. Rubble was everywhere, the front windows to the building blown out. The lobby looked like a building from the Middle East, one Uncle Sam had visited with a drone. The security guard had been injured, but two more horsemen had to be taken to the morgue. He'd lost four good men in a matter of minutes. Jaw tight, Medianoche scowled at his failure. His men were badly mangled. Both would be impossible to identify. Black Mamba had been lifeless when they went into freefall. Medianoche saw part of Dr. Spot's body in the wreckage, from his chest to his neck. His head was gone. It was like he had panicked and tried to jump out of the elevator between floors and decapitated himself. His head was up there somewhere, stuck in the shaft, or maybe down here, bouncing around in the rubble. Rattled and vexed, Tiburon shouted,
"Who the fuck was that guy? A SEAL? A Russian? What nation is he from? A sniper was excused to make an elevator drop, but before all that, takes the time to leave a book? a prepaid phone, and a Father's Day card? Then base jumps from a height that only an expert can handle? Who is he, Medianoche? Who are we fighting, and how many?
Eyes wide, blood boiling, Senorita Raven said, Stand down, Tiburon. Not now. The 6'6", 235-pound albino snapped, I wasn't talking to you. I'm talking to you, 12 fingers. Go feast yourself. Stand down, Tiburon, and I will not ask again. I have 12 years of military service under my belt, and I want some goddamn answers, strap face. 4 of my brothers in arms have been put down by some tango, and I want some goddamn answers. Senorita Raven ran, growled, leapt, and struck Tiburon in the mouth with a right cross. The sucker punch caught him when he was off balance. The big man went down, tasted his own blood, then screamed like an animal. He swept her foot from under her and went after her. It was going to show why they called him the shark. His rage and indignation were greeted by a desperate and frantic elbow to the side of his head. He raised his fist and brought it down on Senorita Raven's ribcage, winded her. He slapped her, and it sounded like thunder. Medianoche exploded. Stand down, both of you! Stand down now! He yanked Tiburon to his feet, shoved him against the wall, his forearm across his throat. Senorita Raven is your XO, and when she orders you to stand down,
I have to stand down for your bitch? We all know your banging strap face. We can tell by the way she frowns at you when you put your eyes on Kiana Savage's sweet black ass. Savage is sleeping in your apartment, and we know she's in your quarters blowing you through the night. We know you're up there fucking that sweet black puss. You ever gonna share the pretty one? You can keep the strap face to yourself. That Haji's not worth a round of doggy.
Stand the fuck down, Tiburon. You're losing it. Calm down and think straight.
Get out of my face, old man. Kiss my six. I'm not high on some damn ass hash. I believe in the plumbing theory and management. All the crap runs downhill, and we're knee-deep in bullshit. Old man, look at this disaster. Father's Day card aside, you and that goddamn raghead cockroach bitch who is sucking your cock better give me some fucking answers.
Senorita Raven managed to spit in Tiburon's face. Tiburon growled and pushed Medianoche away. When Medianoche wouldn't move so Tiburon could get to his XO, Tiburon took a swing, hit Medianoche on his iron jaw. Medianoche retaliated without hesitation, threw 3 rapid blows, the last landing on Tiburon's chin. Medianoche fought him like he was back in the pits. The giant staggered. Medianoche put his foot in the big man's gut, then gave him another blow to the side of the head, then one to the throat. Tiburon dropped, dazed. Medianoche moved behind him, put him in a headlock. Tiburon struggled. Senorita Raven pulled out her blade, snarled, and stabbed Tiburon 12 times. Tiburon reached for his XO, was stabbed in his hands each time. Medianoche twisted Tiburon's neck until it snapped. Panting, Medianoche dropped his soldier. Breathing heavily, Senorita Raven was unhinged. She straddled Tiburon's body, stabbed him over and over, stabbed him and announced with each puncture that it was for every time she had been insulted since 9/11, stabbed him and told Tiburon her blade was because of what comrades like him had done to her, for what they had done to other women who served at their side and who were willing to die for them. Senorita snapped, lost control, was no longer controllable. When she was tired, she stood, took out her sidearm, and put 12 bullets in him, shot him in his manhood each time. Then she reloaded. The explosion had decimated the lobby. Spectators were looking, standing outside in the rain, too far away to see the fight. Vehicles stopped in the street. Sirens announced emergency services were on the way. Senorita Raven continued filling Tiburon's corpse with holes. Medianoche exploded.
Enough! Senorita Raven! Stand!
An excruciating pain rose behind Medianoche's missing eye. His rage was a mountain, and that same rage fueled his blackout. Medianoche felt his brain catch fire, heard it click and fight to whir. Daguerreotype memories played at 20 frames per second, tried to shut him down. Chapter 23 Like Father? Barrio Almagro, Avenida Mirano y Castro Barros. Wearing a black backpack, I emerged from the Line A subte. Face damp, sweat on my neck and palms, I came above ground into cold air. Rain mixed with snow, but that didn't stop people from crowding the sidewalks. Heart beating fast, I took to the streets, hurried by fruit stands, Mexiquiascos and diarios. Colectivo after colectivo passed by. The city buses seemed to run every 3 or 4 minutes. The thousands of cars went by at NASCAR pace, hands in the pockets of my damp hoodie, gun in my right hand, something more powerful in my left. I moved by an uncountable number of businesses, maneuvered around a crowd trying to get inside McDonald's. At the intersection, I saw the name on the legendary eatery, Los Violetas. I pushed open tall glass doors that had golden handles and walked past curved glass into a space that had ceilings high enough to be the roof of a second floor. Las Violetas was huge. Old-world charm and sophistication. Marbled columns, stained glass windows and light fixtures, soaring ceilings and tiled floors. I'd hoped it would be one of the smaller cafes. This place had too many entry points, and I had no idea what was upstairs. Plants were on each side of every massive, polished column. Two small Argentine flags were on each column, too, and a larger version was in the window. I noted each pillar because they were tall and wide, good spots for bad news to hide. Every unknown face was suspicious, even the people who browsed hundreds of cakes and pastries like they were shopping in a mall. Mostly porteñas and others from South America were here. Tea and cakes were Argentine fare, nearly every cake filled with dulce de leche. Nothing gluten-free. Nothing light. The cafe was at least half full. I took a step back, paused to see if anyone had tailed me. Then I stepped forward and noted stairs, hidden corners, the exit to the kitchen. I plotted escape routes, none pretty. I would have to get to the roof and parkour my way to a better position. The glass on the doors and windows was thick enough to take a few bullets without shattering, but if a bomb or rocket was sent this way on my behalf, all bets were off. I'd just shown the horsemen that a sniper didn't give a shit about thick glass. I stayed near the door for a moment, waiting, hunting for the hunters. In a rush, heart thumping, aching from the landing I'd made in the middle of the avenue and getting sideswiped by a car, still feeling pain from the fight I had had with Medianoche and the Vichas. I took my hood off and, moved by the massive confectionery, went toward the swank bar, saw a stairway going up, counted 13 steps in the blink of an eye, then passed the solid marble-topped tables. Café Las Violetas was historic and elegant, but I wasn't here for the aesthetics. All its beauty was a blur. I might as well have been inside a McDonald's on US 62 in Seminole, Texas. White-jacketed waiters moved from table to table and served food on silver platters, but they were all in my way, all suspects. If one looked at me too long, my trigger finger might get itchy, and my gun might cause a case of the hiccups. I took a breath, moved around the red chairs and polished columns, looked back behind me for the third time in 10 seconds, didn't see men and women in black suits or militia thugs in bulletproof clothing. No one came at me with a sledgehammer. I was in the celebrated location where the abuelas of Plaza de Mayo had clandestine meetings camouflaged as birthday celebrations so they could plot a way to save and reclaim as many of their 30,000 kidnapped and missing grandchildren as possible. The disappeared. That was decades ago. Back then, the cold-hearted government would have disappeared radical grandmothers as well. And since I had made that elevator drop and disappear, I was sure what was left of the horseman was bent on finding me. The phone I had in my pocket rang. I recognized the number from the local SIM card. I said, "Which horseman is this?" finally calling from the phone I left behind. A woman said, "For what you have done, you will die, and it will be an ugly death." American accent, a woman. Let me guess. Señorita Raven? "You're fucking dead, Gideon. You are a dead man, just like your mother will be dead soon, just like your two brothers will be dead soon. Just like Scams, all of you will be dead. Keep away from your windows, and tell your crew to be careful riding elevators, too. I ended the call. The phone I'd left was an Android smartphone. Not many phones in Buenos Aires used GPS, but the one I had left was capable. He was in the area. The horsemen were coming. I wasn't sure how they were organized, if they were moving as a group or hunting in pairs. At least 6 of them were here. I had no idea how many had been added to the roster, and I didn't know how many were hunting prey in the USA. I didn't know how many had gone up there and found Shotgun. I didn't know how they had located him. I called Catherine's phone. Again, no one answered. The criminal I was to meet was already waiting at the table most remote from the entrance. He wore a Colombian suit, one made for South American winters, and his shoes were Italian, the best of the best. He sat alone at a table of food, tenderloin steak with mushrooms, grilled chicken, hake, salmon with Roquefort cheese, and a three-colored vegetable puree. He said,
I assume you are Gideon. You worked with my associate, Scams.
Do it right, or this might be your last supper. He nodded.
Sam, I am. Green eggs and ham.
Thank you.
I provided Scams with assistance a few days ago.
I was here. The weapons came from you. He nodded, then said,
I put him in contact with the man leasing a yacht.
Hope he had insurance. He was nervous.
You should try the Martin Carrera salmon. It is served with shrimp, mushrooms, and bacon. You will fall in love with Buenos Aires if you have not already done so.
No thanks.
I ordered it all for you. Take a moment. Eat. If you prefer bacon and eggs or some other sort of American meal, I can arrange that as well, but you must try the Maria Carla Victoriano.
He motioned at a cake, sandwich, and pastry platter. It was a mountain. There was a pitcher of freshly squeezed orange juice and a variety of teas, plus coffee and hot chocolate. Not today. Just give me what I need so I can go. He shifted, nervous.
So, you're the one they call Gideon.
And you're the man they call Assad.
Never heard of you before a few days ago.
Likewise.
Like the white-haired Aussie Assange, neither of us can stay in one country too long. I change phones twice a day and rarely use the same computer for over a week. Someone would love to find an assassinate or send a drone after both of us.
For different reasons.
Word on the street is you're supposed to be the best at what you do. Even if half of what I have heard about you is true, you should be a horseman.
If my old man had raised me, who knows what I might have been.
Who is your father?
No one I'd want to go to the Palermo Parks and play ultimate frisbee with. He nodded.
Please, sit for a moment. All of this food, surely you want a bite. All of this running and killing. You must be starved.
Stop stalling. Stop chatting me up. Give me what was arranged to be picked up.
This will be the last thing. People are assuming that I have assisted you since you arrived. That would hurt my standing. I don't want to risk my relationship in this community.
He reached under his table and eased out a box large enough for a suit and a coat. He said,
"For Miguel Caballero of Bogota, Colombia.
The Armani of bulletproof clothing.
The clothing of presidents, dignitaries, horsemen, and very important gangsters. Specially made for Gideon."
There was a large briefcase as well. I went to the bathroom and came back 3 minutes later, dressed in a dark gray suit and overcoat. My hoodie and old clothes had been trashed. I no longer looked like a hooligan. The suit was flexible, made for running, made for fighting. But most of all, it made me look top shelf. Now I could walk into any bank and get a loan. My trigger fingers' allergies worsened. The arms dealer my London contact had reluctantly used was a broker named Benjamin Assad. The old man stood and shook my hand. His palm was damp. He was stress sweating, more than I was. Then I realized, before there was chatter, now I heard nothing. I pulled my gun and turned. Everything was wrong. There wasn't a waiter on the floor. The customers who had been here were gone, had left in a hurry, their hot meals abandoned. The place was empty, silent, except for me and the international arms dealer. Sweat dripped from his brow. His hand was unsteady. I looked down at the table at his cellular. It was face down. I flipped it over. It was on. Probably had been on the entire time. Someone was listening to us, to me. And I knew then. I picked the phone up and said, "Medianoche." The listener hung up. I slammed the phone in Assad's face. He'd stayed behind to stall me. I'd arrived sooner than expected. I said, "You're a dead man, Assad.
You're two-faced, like Pakistan. You can't take my money, aid me, then give intel to the other side. It doesn't fucking work that way. He quavered.
If I didn't let the four horsemen know, then I would be a dead man. I'm only doing as I was instructed by their leader. For me, this situation is a Kobayashi Maru. It is a no-win for me. They are an assassination squad. I have men, well-trained men, but they all refuse to guard me today. Russians, French, South Africans, Middle Easterners, men from Uruguay. Dozens of assassins refused. You have time to get away. You can escape. I will have to do the same. Like others, I'll seek asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy. I will have no other choice.
I don't give a damn about your problems. Tell me, did my London contact cross me?
No, no, she didn't. She has no idea. London is out of her league. She's a nobody.
The rifle was as ordered. The rest of the merchandise you sold me is bogus? He shivered again.
No, it's good. If you live, remember I gave you what you ordered.
So did Pontius Pilate. He gave the people what they wanted.
Please, have some consideration. I am simply a man who gives people what they need. I am a salesman. I am only a salesman.
The safe house in Villa Pueyrredon?
They're there waiting, in case you make it that far.
I put my backpack on my left shoulder, took the briefcase in my left hand, kept my gun in my right hand. Assad moved, pulled his jacket back, and went for a gun he had in his holster. I shot him in the right shoulder, and he let his weapon fall, then raised his left hand in defeat. I said, that was stupid.
Yes, yes it was. My desperation got the best of me.
How much did they offer you?
To be able to run my arms from here, undisturbed, for the next 6 months.
You won't collect a bounty. Not one on my head.
I am an important man. I can get you what you need. I can arrange another safe house. There is one they don't know about in the residential area of Cabecito, near Parque Rivadavia. It's in a classy, understated barrio with tree-lined avenues, cobblestone streets, and beautiful parks.
Do I look like I'm here to be a tourist?
It's safe.
He spat out the address, then stressed.
I guarantee you won't be found there.
The problem is, you know about it.
Trust me. You can trust me.
Ain't no trust between us, Assad, and that's bad. You had a nice first impression going there, especially when you offered me food, because I am hungry, but you blew it. I ejected the clip in my gun, dropped it in my pocket, then loaded it with another one from my backpack. Sweat dripped down the back of my neck, but Assad sweated more. I swapped 9mm bullets for RIP ammo, the same ammunition I had used when I took out one of the horsemen in the elevator. The infamous bullet banned by the Hague Convention was the devil. Assad held his wounded shoulder, stumbled by a red chair, huffed and puffed and tried to hurry away. The international arms dealer tried to scurry toward the rear of the restaurant. I didn't know what was back there. He could have been running to open a door for other horsemen. I hit him in the neck with an RIP. He didn't even scream. The bullet exploded inside his body, sent metal in 9 directions at once, to every point on a compass. He stopped moving. His body stood where it was, swayed a bit. Blood dripped from the gash in his head. He didn't know he was dead. But his ruptured brain figured it out, because he dropped to the beautiful marble floor. He'd taken my money and double-crossed me with a handshake. As soon as I turned, 2 people hurried through the crowd, moving up and down the avenue, and rushed toward the entrance. They rushed toward the same heavy glass doors I had used, the entrada on the side where more than 100 suites were located. I was across the room, 20 yards away, on the restaurant side. The marble columns were why they didn't see me from the outside. Horsemen were galloping my way, dressed in their trademark suits and overcoats. This time, it was a man and a woman. The man looked like Hercules. He was on a raw meat and steroids diet. The tall, dark-skinned woman had an afro and looked like Pam Grier. I recognized both from their photographs. All the intel I had received from my London contact had been good. I tried to do the rest without Constantine, and it was going sideways. In my heart, I wanted to go toe-to-toe with Hercules. I wanted to fight him hand-to-hand, elbow-to-elbow, and knee-to-knee, and beat him down into the center of Hades. I knew I could do it, but I didn't have time. This was about bullets, not fists. I would be a fool to bring fists to a gunfight. I didn't have time to use fishing line to set a trap. I would have to go old school. I pulled out earplugs, rushed to get them in.
the next stage of the war was about to erupt. As soon as Hercules put his hand on the golden handle of the heavy glass door, I pulled the pin on an M67 fragmentation grenade and rolled it in his direction. I stood behind a marble column, used that for cover. He'd seen me move. He rushed inside, threw smoke and flash in my direction. He pulled an AR-15 from underneath his coat, started popping. He had come to party, and he wanted to party hard. Then Hercules looked down, saw the grenade I tossed, knew he had less than 4 seconds, screamed to his horsemen, tried to retreat, but it was too late. She had been on his heels. She was in his way. He stumbled into her. The muscle-bound man hit her like a wall, knocked her back. The explosion rocked the front of the cafe. The energy rolled over me, felt like a tsunami of air. Pastries were destroyed, glass broke, wooden tables became splinters that could do just as much damage as glass. The sound left me temporarily deafened. Smoke from his grenade filled the air, tainted my lungs. Aching, I removed my earplugs, rushed, gathered my things, stumbled toward curved glass doors, their French-stained glass windows shattered. The Italian marble floors were damaged. A historical landmark had been desecrated. I stepped over the broken glass, fragments crunching under my military-style shoes, and saw that a few people on the street had been injured. A near-death experience was a terrifying thing. Denizens were traumatized, some more by the sight of the historic building being damaged than by the horsemen suffering on the sidewalk. Even before I stepped into the frigid air, what I had done sickened me. I had visited many, but it had never been like this. I was slaying the devil's men as if they had the value of a dragonfly, because their mission statement was to do the same to me. The day was as violent as a production of the Parisian playhouse Le Théâtre de Grand Guignol. This horror wasn't entertaining. It sickened me. But to defeat a horseman, you had to be as cruel as a horseman. Hercules decorated the sidewalk. He'd lost both of his hands, and his left leg would never be any good. He had a sucking chest wound. He was unrecognizable. If not for the suit, it would have been hard to tell he was human. He had caught the brunt of the explosion, and Foxy Brown had been a victim of its energy, had been blown 20 feet into a car. A horrified Pretenia in the crowd said the Morena was upside down when she hit the car, had bounced off the car, and landed head first. She'd hyperextended her neck, slammed the back of her head, then landed face first on the concrete. In the middle of what looked like a jackery, I thought she was dead. Then she moved. Her eyes flickered. She twitched, moved like the pain was registering and coming in waves that rivaled a tsunami. She was down, disoriented, but she knew she was in trouble. She was blinded by agony and trying desperately to crawl to her gun. She was back on the battlefield. She moved 2 inches, crawled in the wrong direction. As more Pretanias came to see what had happened, I went to the gun and picked it up, dropped it in my backpack. All eyes were on her, not the gun. Many had never seen a Morena, or seen an afro. A little girl went to Foxy Brown and touched her hair, then ran back to her mother. Foxy Brown and Hercules wore identical suits. Both wore paisley ties, green the dominant color. They looked like Gladys Knight and a Pip who would never Pip again. I put 2 fingers to the side of Foxy Brown's head and said, "Bang, bang, bang." She was one of a kind down here. She was the third one I'd almost hit with the sniper rifle. Next to us, her friend Hercules did the death rattle. Sounded like his insides did the Harlem shake. He did his final inhale, then exhaled. Foxy Brown wheezed, coughed, choked, called out in agony. Tears rivered from her eyes. Shrapnel was stuck in her hands. Her palms and fingers bled. Her bulletproof top coat had almost been blown off of her. Her suit coat had been blown open, too. It revealed her plum-colored bra and her gun holster. I adjusted her blouse, closed her jacket, made her decent. Then I made sure she didn't have another gun before I took in the small crowd. If I'd been in the United States, everyone would have been recording. But people just looked and gasped. Some turned away from the horror. Someone thought there was a gas leak and told everyone to move back. Not everyone had seen the guns on the pavement. I said, "This is what happens when you find Gideon." Eyes closed tight, tears of pain falling. She spat out blood, cursed 12 times, moved like she wanted to get up and become a horseman again. made an ugly expression inspired by acute pain, then surrendered to her condition, panted like she was in the final seconds of labor, then replied,
"Ears hurting, ringing, pulled a groin muscle. Oh God, my neck, blew out my left shoulder."
Her nose was broken, mouth bloodied, front teeth broken, afro damp with winter rain. She made 100 sounds, like she was livid because pain was hitting her on many levels, agony a constantly changing pattern that put the hues of a kaleidoscope in her head. Angry and frightened, she whispered,
"We fucked up.
Big time.
We thought Assad had you. We fucked up and rushed in."
"You are consumed with assassinating me."
"We fucked up. But we are not done. We are not done."
I rubbed my face, sweat greasy and thick like blood, then squeezed her damaged fingers as tightly as I could, added to the kaleidoscope that had her begging. "How many horsemen are coming for me?" She kicked and yelled, slobbered and squirmed in the soft leather seat, then, when I let her hand go, made a stream of whimpering sounds. As my heart pounded, as stress poured from my pores, as my trigger finger kept hiccuping, I said, "How many are in your military convoy?" In a rough voice, she said,
"3.
Including Medianoche?
"Yes."
"How many vehicles?"
"I need medical attention."
"Get in line. How many are coming after me right now?" She didn't answer. I held her fingers again, applied pressure. Her pain ballooned. Again, she screamed. I asked, "How many?" The pain made her leg tremble like she was delirious.
2. 1 car, 1 motorcycle.
"Where is the beast?"
"I feel blood coming out of my ear."
"Where is the beast?"
"He's dead."
"Was he on the elevator? Was that who was with you?"
"No, no, no. He was KIA before I came, by the Scams organization."
"Scams organization? That British bastard wasn't organized."
"That's all I know."
"I'm glad the beast is dead. One less for me to have to fight and put in the ground. And thanks for handling Scams. Sooner or later, I would have found him and done the same."
"Help me."
"Call the Red Cross. Africa Vive. I think that's Argentina's version of the NAACP.
"I'm hurting all over. I'm dying."
"Don't worry. The pain will stop when you're dead. I died once. I got over it." I patted her down, removed a cellular and a black credit card. She had keys to a Mercedes. Cars had stopped. Traffic was at a standstill. I looked at the window and door that had been destroyed, at the dozen people who were bloodied and wounded. It had been unavoidable. I backed away, called the last number dialed on her phone. Senorita Raven answered on the first ring. "You have him?" "No, they don't. One is with Assad, the other is on her way to the same hell." She said, "We know where she is. Thelma is Catherine. Her sons are Robert and Sven." Then I hung up and took 2 more steps in retreat. Then turned around. I stepped over Hercules and went back to Foxy Brown. In Castellano, I told the crowd she was my girlfriend, that she was from South Africa, a diplomat, and the embassy wanted me to take her to Hospital Allemand. Hearing every tick of every clock created by man, I asked the horseman, "Where is your goddamn car?" She tried to motion toward the intersection of Avenida Medrano and Avenida Rivadavia. Sirens came this way. Sounded like alarms were coming from all directions. I carried Foxy Brown into a drizzle of rain and snow. Dim skies covered us. I transported her, my backpack, a briefcase, and more malice than any man should ever have tainting his soul. I became a man who was carrying his wounded lover to get medical attention. I dropped her in the passenger seat of the bulletproof sedan and sped away. Took Avenida Rivadavia, my eyes on the rear view. I had gone back to her for a reason. I needed information. I needed the truth. Her life for the truth. Heart beating like it wanted to escape my chest, I yelled, "Wake up!"
"My head hurts."
Her words slurred like she was drunk.
"I can't stay awake."
"Wake up!"
Don't go to sleep.
She leaned forward, regurgitated on the floor mat. Soon, I raced down the widest avenue in the world, Avenida Nueve de Julio. It was as if New York's Times Square and Paris's Avenue des Champs-Élysées had an overweight baby and raised it on fast food and sugary drinks. The network of traffic was consistent and extensive, but was made worse because plate-banging protesters had taken over other thoroughfares, had blocked traffic to protest Brazil, to protest a paper plant in Uruguay, were marching for the right to have abortions. There were many ways to go, plenty of places to hide and regroup, and I imagined them all. El Caminito, Plaza de Mayo, Plaza Dorrego, Teatro Colón, Museo Casa Carlos Gardel, Café San Juan, Museo Benito Quinquela Martín, Centro Cultural Kirchner, Jardín Zoológico. Risking being set up, I stuck to Avenida Nueve de Julio. The streets were choked with garbage waiting on carteneros, while tourists took photos of a large painting of Eva Perón at a microphone. Argentina was filled with images. Carlos Gardel, Ernesto Che Guevara, Maria Eva Duarte de Perón, Rita Jorge Luis Borges, and the cartoon character Mafalda. Crowds were by Teatro Colón, the Obelisk, and Plaza de la República. People walked fast, some at a gait faster than joggers. I was in the epicenter of Buenos Aires, with restaurants, hotels, and hole-in-the-wall shops all around. Armed police were near the obelisk watching tourists, taking pictures. Criminals were out there, too. The congested and polluted avenue was populated with pickpockets mixed in with homeless adults and children, all with hands out, begging for pesos. I was caught at a light, stuck in the vehicle exhaust pollution. The moment I stopped, three guitar players came to the window and serenaded. There was a fire juggler and a guy inside a hula hoop who rolled around in front of the stopped cars. When the light changed, it was like the Grand Prix out of the gate. I zoomed with the madness of the city again. I barked at Foxy Brown.
Wake up! Wake up!
We have some talking to do. She groaned.
I'm hurting. Feels like every part of my body is broken. I need help.
You'll hurt worse if I open that car door and push you out in traffic. She made a sound like death was dancing in her lungs. How many horsemen are left in Atlanta? She treaded in pain, tried not to drown in her agony.
We lost three, but one is left, and the one left is the meanest soldier I've ever met.
I asked, do you know where Thelma is?
Outside of Atlanta. In Smyrna.
Smyrna? She's in Smyrna?
We found her. Medianoche put an order out on her an hour ago.
What's the order?
Wake up!
What's the order? Talk to me or get dropped.
Blackout. Whoever's in the house, whoever is with her. Shit! I'm hurting!
My world turned blood red. I said, thanks for telling me what I needed to know. I pulled out my gun, aimed it at her head, itchy finger on the trigger, R.I.P. bullet eager. As she begged me not to pop her, as she begged me to not do to her what she and the four horsemen of the apocalypse itched to do to me, a BMW motorcycle pulled up next to the car, same type of motorcycle that had tried to trap and kill the scams organization days ago. The horseman who rocked it looked at me, saw that Foxy Brown wasn't behind the wheel, saw her half dead in the passenger seat, beaten down and bloodied like a POW. She groaned like she was being held hostage in the jungle west of Da Nang, South Vietnam's second largest city. That wasn't what he expected to see. As we moved like NASCAR in 16 lanes of madness, the element of surprise was on my side. To defeat a horseman, I had to be as cruel as one. Without hesitation, I cut hard, rammed the BMW, hit him hard enough to make both of us lose control. I regained control, but the surprise Sicario dropped and skidded on the damp avenue, then vanished underneath a speeding 18-wheel Supermercado jumbo truck. The motorcycle was trampled by 80,000 pounds. I saw that in my rear view. It happened quick. It was already over before the 18-wheeler slammed on its brakes. Wasn't easy to stop 40 tons from moving. Some traffic stopped behind me, but many just swerved and moved around the accident, kept going like they had better things to do. While I sped with traffic, Foxy Brown groaned a dozen more times, struggled to breathe, suffered. Given the chance, she would have done the same to me. then gone to eat an empanada. Suddenly, she went limp, like she had lost consciousness. Her chest expanded and contracted. She was breathing. The windshield wiper glided back and forth as I snapped, "Wake up!"
"Okay, okay, okay."
"Did Medianoche tell you who I am?"
"You're our enemy. You're a terrorist. You're a Taliban. You're the bad guy."
She gagged, threw up again. She made a mess, then sat back, eyes closed. She was losing consciousness. I yelled, "Wake up! We're not done talking. Wake up! Wake up! Wake up!" I was so busy watching traffic and checking my rear view that I didn't see the knife. Foxy Brown growled and attacked me. She attacked me with her eyes closed, had a blade in her bloodied hand. It must have been in a stash spot under the seat. Sneaky bitch had a combat knife, a 5-inch. She stabbed me in my right shoulder. She had been trying to stick me in my neck. The strike was weak, but the blade was razor sharp. Then she tried to get the strength to stab me again. I squeezed her wounded leg, and her pain brought sense back to her head. The blade dropped on her lap. I took it from her, was tempted to push her out. She mumbled,
"You're my enemy."
I touched my shoulder where it ached. There was no blood. The Colombian suit I had gotten from Assad was legit. Too bad he wasn't. I looked over at Foxy Brown, ready to watch her bounce along the dirty streets. Her clothes had loosened. When she had attacked me, her left breast had tumbled free from her colorful bra, dark nipple and dark areola. I reached over and hoiked up her jacket, closed it the best I could. She stopped groaning. I didn't have time to see if she was still breathing. Didn't care. If you pulled a thorn out of a lion's foot, it would still eat you alive. Medianoche and Senorita Raven could track me. This car had GPS, and that was how the sicario on the motorcycle had found the car. He might have had time to tell them I had the car and had captured a horseman. They knew where I was. That meant the family reunion would happen sooner than I had hoped. I drove for 13 miles, went from downtown Buenos Aires to greater Buenos Aires. Snow was on the ground. I was in a calmer, quiet, suburban town named Ciudad Evita. I eased down Avenida José Mario Bevilacqua. Soon, I crept down España, did the same on El Shawar. No horsemen appeared. I eased by run-down apartment buildings in the working-class town. There were one-story brick homes, parks, woods, sports center, car wash, bookstore. Passed garbage on the side of the roads in one section, then cleanliness and monuments of Evita and her husband Perón in another. The city was built for the working man, and when viewed from the sky, was shaped like Evita's profile. Her name and image were everywhere, same as Elvis Presley's image and name dominated Elvis Presley Boulevard in Memphis, Tennessee. A welcome sign said, "Ciudad Evita was a National Historic Monument of Argentina." What stood out the most was a gigantic picture of Evita.